Welcome to episode 59 of the DexTees podcast, brought to you by LegitMTG.com. My name is Erin Campbell. My guest tonight is Channel Fireball's English Rose. She is most well known for coming in 32nd place at Pro Tour in Nagoya in 2011 after only playing the game for 18 months. How on earth do you do that? I'm going to find out tonight. Hello, Carrie Oliver.
Hi.
Hi. First time on a podcast.
Yes, that's right.
Okay. I'm very excited. It's been a while since I've had a first timer on my show before.
Yeah, I'm a little nervous, as you can probably tell, but I'm looking forward to losing my podcast virginity.
Oh,
so
my
we'll
goodness.
See how this goes.
I think you and I are going to get along just fine.
All right. Sounds good.
The reason I wanted to have you on my show, Carrie, is like I said, I've been following your articles for a while, and specifically, I actually read your most recent article about the Cerberus.
Yes.
Which I loved.
Spoiler season is good fun to write for, actually, because you can just throw out random decks that, if you're lucky, they might become vaguely playable, but people are just excited to see what you can do with new cards.
So yeah, and I definitely look to people like you to sort of tell me where to go, because I'm not a very good deck builder, and sometimes I'm not able to put those pieces together. So, you know, when you wrote about the Cerberus, I love black cards. I'm very much a black mage, and I admit that I hadn't really given the Cerberus a good look, and when I read your article and I saw where you were going, it was like, see, she's got the eye for it that I just don't, and we really need people like you around to do that for us. I was glad you wrote that.
Yeah. Spoiler season is cool for that sort of thing, because everyone sees something slightly different in their cards. Like, I don't look at the spoiler and see the potential of every card, but some cards appeal to what, like, the sort of play styles that I like, and then I'll read someone else's article and I'll be like, oh yeah, that card's also kind of cool. So it works out nicely. It's good.
Yeah. See, I have a really bad habit of doing that and taking it too seriously. So, like, I was playing Jund a while back, you know, the mid-range Jund. And because so many people were playing it, I would go to read Duke's articles and Reed Duke would say, you should do this. And then, you know, I would go to somebody else and they would have a different makeup. And I would just get really confused. And I was like, well, he's really good, but she's good too. And he's even better. And I didn't know who to listen to and I didn't know who to trust. And finally, I just gave up Jund altogether because I just felt like I couldn't keep up. And I it was almost like my head exploded.
That's fair enough. I've got this very, very awesome image in my head of you sort of flicking between websites going, I don't know which one to do, I don't know which one to do, and they're just throwing the deck out of the window. I can't cope.
If you ever saw, are you familiar with the cartoon Invader Zim?
The what? Sorry?
There was a cartoon a couple years ago called Invader Zim.
I don't think I've seen that.
Okay, well, it's a really fun, it's one of those cartoons that if kids watch it, they would get something out of it and adults could enjoy it too. It was sort of like a counterculture cartoon. And there was a robot on the show named Gurr, G-I-R. And whenever Gurr would get really excited about things, his head would explode. And the way that I would describe that to people is I had a Gurr head explosion. And people who've seen the show are like, oh, we get it. So it happens to me quite a bit.
Fair enough. I mean, yeah, there is... almost, well, there probably is too much information out there. The secret, I think, to reading articles is to pick some people that you like, that possibly you either value their opinion, or their opinions are often very in line with how you like to think or play. And read those, because always, yeah, you just end up with too much information.
Yeah. So I want to talk about you, because your opinion is one that I value.
Thank you.
So let's get started talking about you. So as I said in the intro of the show, you came in 32nd place at Pro Tour Nagoya in 2011, and you had only been playing the game for 18 months. Kind of walk me through how that happens. Like, how do you go from playing Duels of the Planeswalkers at home to literally making Pro Tour history? Like, walk me through that.
Yeah, to be honest, it's a bit of a mystery to me, but I can tell you what I did. So I started playing Duels of the Planeswalker because my friend had it on his Xbox, and then my housemate also purchased a copy on our Xbox, so I sort of sat and played that a bunch, and I was like, this is a cool game. I've always liked board games and card games in general. This was kind of my first encounter with a trading card game, but I was like, yeah, you know, I like this, it's got mechanics, it does stuff, and obviously anyone who's played Duels appreciates that it's kind of quite different from the real life game, in that the cards work the same, but you don't have priorities and stacks at quite the same times, and you can't do stuff in the pre-com. So going back to Duels of the Planeswalkers is really annoying, because you're like, but I want to do something end of in the end of combat step, and I can't. That's really annoying. But anyway, so you know, I played a bunch of that, and then my friend who he'd sort of got more into the idea of Magic the Gathering rather than Jewels of the Planeswalker, so he'd like bought some cards on eBay, and we'd sort of looked at them and gone, oh, these are kind of exciting. And then he was like, there's a pre-release coming up. And I was like, what? What's a pre-release? It was Worldwake. And after he told me, you know, we get the new set, I was like, what's a set? We got through all this, all the sort of like
glossary.
Yeah, exactly. I was just like, I was completely oblivious to all of these words. But we got there and we decided to go. And that was back in the time where you had regional pre-releases. So we went to a big one in London, which I thought was great, because if it had just been my local game store, that would have been quite intimidating, because there's like 30 people, most of which know each other, whereas there was a giant room with like 200 people in it, none of which were paying attention to me. So I could just like go in and go, so what's a sealed pool? But anyway, so, you know, we went, and I went 2-2 in my first sealed event, and I was like, well, that was fun. And I kind of got hooked, and I started going to my LGS, drafting every week. After I'd got some sort of sizable collection, I sort of started doing standard. So that was about 6 months or so. And then there was the big announcement about extended PTQs, extended becoming a thing, the smaller extended version, the short extended that has now died. You know what?
Yeah.
Anyway, and the PTQ list came up, and I was like, what's a PTQ? Well, I didn't actually pay any attention to what a PTQ was at all, but there was a tournament being held in Cambridge where I live, and I was like, that's cool. And we looked up some lists, and so it was like just after, because I think they played extended at the Worlds that year, and then it was the PTQ season after that. So we looked up some lists that had done reasonably well. And there was like blue, white, black, Tempered Steel, with like Fortsies and Tempered Steel and Memnites and Wimbrisk Heights. And Fortsies was quite expensive, although actually relatively cheap compared to what it is now. But I decided to ditch those because I didn't have any, and just play white, blue. And went to this PTQ, lost the first round, and I was like, oh, well, you know, I wasn't expecting to do very well. And I kind of won the rest of my games after that.
How many rounds were there?
So I think it must have been an 8-round Swiss. It might only have been 7. Wow. It might have been a small one. I think I got to ID the last round, and then obviously the top 8. But it was about the 6th round that I said to my friend, so what is this tournament?
What happens if I win?
And they were like, well, it's to go to a pro tour. And I was like, where? And they were like, in Nagoya. I was like, is that in Japan? Because I'd love to go to Japan. I didn't even know what it was for. I just turned up to play Magic. Because at the end of the day, that's what I've always enjoyed. You know, I like Magic. I like playing the cards. I like seeing all the interactions. And so it was my second PTQ, I guess, because I went to a limited one right at the end of the previous season. But at the end of the day, I think I got so far so fast because I just played so much. I loved the game. It wasn't, you know, I've done sort of logic games and problem solving, all those sort of skills that you need in Magic in various other sort of games and whatever, and I played Bridge quite competitively before I entered Magic, so I could bring a lot of those skills with me, but it's just almost just sheer volume. Of all my friends that started at the same time, I just played too much, or possibly more. But I mean, yeah, and then I went to the Pro Tour, and nowadays, like, you know, you go to if I'm lucky enough to qualify for a Pro Tour, I'll go like a week ahead, and I'll have like a testing group, and we'll try all the different decks, all the combinations, try and break the format. It doesn't work. Everyone tries it. Mm-hmm. It works that one time. When I went to Nagoya, I was like, yeah, this sounds like an awesome holiday. So we went to Tokyo for a couple of days. And then we turned up in Nagoya like a day before the Pro Tour started. And you know, I did a little bit of testing with my boyfriend who traveled with me. But you know, it was not anything serious. And I changed deck at the last minute. I was gonna play Mono White Tempest still, which kind of was pretty dominant in that Scars of Mirrodin block format, but I changed to mono red because I thought it could beat it, which I did fairly well against it on the day, so I guess it could.
Good call.
But I literally walked into the room and I was like, all right, I'm probably never qualifying for a Pro Tour ever again. I should probably have some fun. obviously, I did pretty well after that, but it turned out at the Pro Tour scene that everyone just plays Magic, which you talk to people and they're like, what's it like to play at the Pro Tour? And you're like, well, you play Magic, and as long like you can't make mistakes, but I mean, at all levels of Magic, you make a mistake and your opponent doesn't, you'll probably lose. At the Pro Tour, they make less mistakes. Like, it's that simple. I mean, obviously, there's issues of deck choice, and you can get luckier than other people. You know, if you rip the lightning bolt off the top for free damage and they're on free, then you know you win. But you know, I went. It turns out I could play Magic as well as the best people, which was quite a terrifying sort of prospect. Because yeah,
And see, that's what I
like
wanted to
so.
ask you is like, you had mentioned sort of, your initial PTQ and your initial experiences. You sort of had like this wide-eyed wonder about you, and you really weren't in it for the prizes, or that wasn't really an overwhelming concern for you. Was there a part of you when you got the Pro Tour invite where it hit you, where you're like, oh my God, I'm going to a Pro Tour. I'm not ready. I can't do this. Did that ever cross your mind, or did you still have that sense of wonder?
I was just really excited. I mean, I actually couldn't sleep for 3 nights after I won my qualifier.
Oh.
Like, I just couldn't sleep. I actually spent the whole 3 nights remembering all the mistakes I'd made during the PTQ. Like every single misplay came back to haunt me. It's like, this is stupid. I won. And I'm lying in bed worrying about the fact that I couldn't. And also, I was remembering all the awesome plays and how I'd won and what I'd drawn off the top to clinch the victory. And, you know, everything replayed. But I didn't worry about, like, when I went, like, as I said, when I walked in, I decided I was just going to have fun because I thought I was just going to be horribly outclassed. My goal was not to go oh was to go not to go 07. No, is it 8 rounds or 7 rounds? It's 8 rounds. Not to go 08 because I decided that would be too embarrassing. As long as I won some matches, like, yeah, and I think that probably helped a lot. I always play my best Magic when I'm having fun. If I'm trying too hard, I'll do terribly. If I'm having a laugh, I tend to do much better. I think that's probably why that was my most successful Pro Tour experience, because I kind of cared a bit more afterwards.
I think that's part of the reason why I found your story to be so refreshing, Carrie, is because everywhere you go, you see a lot of the try hard. And I'll admit that I'm guilty of it too, where you think about it so much, and you're like you said, you're trying to break the format, or you're trying to figure it all out, and you're so in it to win it. And I really like how you got here, that that was so not your approach. And I would like to see more people have that approach, because I just feel like we don't see many people doing that. And that's something I sort of vowed to myself that I would like to try in this coming standard season. Because in this past season, I've struggled with a bit of tilt, and I realized that maybe if I did just have a laugh, maybe I could defeat the tilt that way, and maybe I could just have fun, and maybe that would lead to more success. So what you're doing and what you've had a lot of success with is what I'd like to try to do going forward.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it can be really hard to do that because, like, I mean, you want to win, and I have my most fun when I'm winning. I will admit that, hands up. You know, I like to win at Magic. I like to win at everything. I blame my mum. She always used to throw games when I was little so that I could win. Just made me a terrible loser because I think I should win all the time. But like, so like the World Magic Cup qualifier that I won last year, you know, I'd literally brewed up mono green Dungrave Elder the night before. Like, it'd been a deck in the past, but everyone had forgotten about it and it'd gotten out of favor. And I'd sat there and brewed it with my friend and gone with Revenge of the Hunted. And I'd gone, there's no way this can be competitive. But I played it anyway, and I just had the best fun, like miracling Revenge of the Hunted off the top, and my opponent's face just dropping as all of their creatures had to run under the bus, and my bus still stayed alive. And I just spent the whole day laughing. don't think my opponents enjoyed it, but I enjoyed it. And again, that was another tournament where I didn't notice my wins and my losses. You know, I got to the final, you know, on the wave of just having a lot of fun. And it does make a lot of difference. Mental mindset is ignored by a lot of people. And yeah, if you can work on that, I would definitely say do it.
Now, up until Melissa DeTora made top eight at Pro Tour Gatecrash, you actually held the record for highest showing by a woman at an individual Pro Tour. How did it feel to make your mark on the scene like that? Like when all was said and done and you realized that you were that woman, what did you feel? What'd you think?
It was pretty cool. I was kind of bitter that Melissa took it away from me, I'm gonna be honest. Like it was cool that we got a girl in the top eight of a Pro Tour, but that was kind of my goal, to be the first girl in the top eight of a Pro Tour. So now I'm just gonna have to settle for being the first girl to win a Pro Tour.
There you go.
I'm joking, but although that would obviously be nice. But no, I mean that was a really cool feeling actually. I don't I think the reason we don't see lots of women doing really well at these events is there just aren't enough of us playing it. It goes to show that my finish and then Melissa's finish, you know, we can quite happily put in these appearances at Pro Tours. There just aren't that many of us necessarily trying at that level. There aren't there I don't know what it's like in America, but at the PTQs in England we don't get that many girls showing up. And when I speak to girls at my stores, they're just not that interested in competing. Like they're quite happy playing, they have a laugh, but they don't want to be cutthroat and win a tournament. Which, in fairness, like when I went to a PDQ, that wasn't my intent. So I don't know. Maybe that's not true.
Do you get women
But it
like,
was.
do you get women emailing you or messaging you about what you've done and how they look up to you or anything?
I have had a couple, especially just after the after Nagoya. I had a couple of people, and people often come up to me in person. But I would say that there's as many girls as there are, like, you know, proportionally there's as many girls as there are guys, but obviously there's a lot less girls. Not certain that came out right.
I
You knew what I meant.
do. I do. Do you feel, I have to ask this anytime I have a good female player on the show. Do you feel that the environment, like, have you had any negative experiences in the environment, as a female player?
I haven't. This is something. So when Jackie came over for GP
Manchester?
Manchester, a little while back, we actually shared a room together, and we were talking about this because I always get the impression from the American market that this is a big thing because everyone always wants to talk about it. They're like, oh, you know, do you feel like all the guys are like, you know, dissing you? I'm like, no. Because but so when Jackie came over, she was like, I totally get why you don't think this is an issue, because it's not an issue in England. Like, not just in Magic, like on the streets. She genuinely felt like England was a lot more just accepting of people however they were. And like, I don't think that's a completely fair statement. Like, we have our own prejudices, or people have their prejudices. But she said that in America, she gets the feeling, I probably shouldn't be quoting Jackie, it's not really fair, but she gets the feeling that everyone has to be, what's the word, put in boxes. You know, girls are meant to wear pink and wear dresses, and guys are meant to be in jeans and rolling around in the mud. And that's sort of imprinted from a young age in adverts and whatever, and it is carried over into adult life. In England, I have had one guy being a bit of a douche on an internet forum at me afterwards, after I beat him in the PTQ. But genuinely, I have received no rubbish in real life, and I'm quite grateful for that. So it's certainly not been an issue for me. I've had crap on the internet. It's painful. I ignore it. I find that's the best solution for me. Like when comments in articles on Channel Fireball weren't very well controlled, I obviously got a lot of crap. But yeah, genuinely, it's not an issue in real life in England. I did get one guy once come up to his friend. I was sat at the table at the PTQ after that round, and we just sort of stayed sitting where we were. And his mates had come over and started talking to him. Another one of his mates turned up and was like, did you win? And he was like, no. So he was like, oh, you got beat by a girl. I was like, I've beaten lots of people. And went back to reading my book. And I kind of shut down after that.
I had a Kim Warren on my show, the famous judge, and I think she said something to that same effect, that it's just because I think I'd asked her what it was like being a female judge and if there was you know, any sort of safety there as opposed to being a female player. And she said something along similar lines, that it's so different over there, and that, you know, you do have your bad apples, but as a whole, it's just not a thing there. And that's also very refreshing to me, because I know so many women over here, like you had mentioned, a lot of the women that you know, Carrie, they're more interested, they're more not interested in competitive play because they're just not interested in it. But I know far too many women here that are interested, but they just feel like there's not enough safe spaces, or they feel like, you know, that they're being looked down on, and that prevents them from playing. So it's a little disheartening to hear that we mostly have it over here. And that
it's a shame. I don't know when that's going to change. Mm-hmm. I guess but hopefully people will grow up.
So you had mentioned that you are, of course, with Channel Fireball, which is a big deal, writing for them. Tell me how that got started. How'd you get picked up by them?
So it's one of those being in the right place at the right time stories, because so obviously I did well at Proto Nikoya, and I was invited by Gathering Magic to write them a tournament report, which was then run by Trick Jarrett, who's now at MTG Daily. And I was like, I'd written one tournament report before for an English website after I won my PTQ. And I was like, well, okay, I do it again. And so I did that. And he then offered to ask me if I would like to write every week. And at school, my worst subject was French. My second worst subject was English. I hated it with a passion, particularly creative writing.
Well, there goes
yeah, exactly. And this is literally, I've avoided any writing up until this point. And I was like, basically, I said yes because I wanted to say no. I've taken in recent times to doing things that scare me. I'm not talking about bungee jumping. I'm not doing bungee jumping. That terrifies me. But I didn't think I was likely to die if writing went wrong. Because if writing went wrong, I'd just go back to not writing, and that would be fine. So I started writing for him every week. And I was basically, it was kind of nice because Gathering Magic's quite a small website, and people that go there quite a sort of committed audience. And they would leave very nice comments about what I'd written. And I felt like some people were gaining useful insights from my writing, and so I sort of grew in confidence. And they had a very nice editing system, and they would send me back comments, and so my writing sort of slowly improved. And then I went to Grind Planeswalker Point. It was at, I had the next Pro Tour, which was Pro Tour Philadelphia. So I played Paolo at Nagoya.
Paolo.
And beaten him quite resoundly. Paolo Victor Dama de Rosa.
The lips.
I know. so we'd sort of hit it off a bit because we've both played bridge. He still plays bridge competitively in Brazil. So we sort of had that in common. So we'd actually played bridge on the Sunday of the Pro Tour rather than cube or any other magic related thing. So when I went over to Philadelphia, it was very nice, actually. LSV actually introduced himself to me, which I thought was a high honor, because I was like, surely I should be like, I don't know, bowing down and worshipping you. I don't know. Lewis V. I was telling a friend this story the other day, and he was like, he introduced himself to you, but he's a god.
I've called him that before, too, but in a whole different capacity.
you know, I sort of got to know more of the Channel Fireball team, I suppose, that way. And then I got to do some cube with Gavin Verhey, who was then writing for Star City Games, and Tristan Sean Gregson, who was then involved with Channel Fireball. And so I sort of got to know people, which is kind of the secret to media, I guess. And then when I went out to Grind Planeswalker Points, which was the most miserable time in my life, although the trip to Worlds was very fun. I had a lot of fun when I wasn't playing Magic, Grounds, and Planeswalker Points. I met some really cool people on that trip that have been become lifelong friends. But so I was out there then, and TSG actually just straight up asked me, what do we need to do to get you to write for Channel Fireball? And I was like, you could ask me. Because Channel Fireball is kind of where I learned to draft. You know, I watched LSV videos. You know, that was my bread and butter of how do you actually draft this format? And you know, it'd sort of become my little private goal that I would write for Channel Fireball in the future. But I was spending sort of like 3 years, not 4 months. So yeah, I mean, it's a story of who you, I mean, they'd obviously seen my work at Gathering Magic and they'd liked it. But it is a story of getting to know the right people. So yeah, I was kind of lucky, but I'm very happy where I am now. So it's good.
It seems like everything that's happened to you has happened so fast. Have you really had a chance to like let it sink in? Like, I'm Carrie Oliver. I write the Channel Fireball. I top 32 to Pro Tour. Wow. Like, what, you know, what was that like when it hit you? Like, oh my God.
I don't know if it does. Every now and then I sort of, you know, it someone will remind me of it. I met a very sweet guy at some PTQs recently that we've become quite good friends with, and he actually calls me Channel Fireball's Carrie Oliver when he feels like teaching me, and I'm like, oh yeah, that's me. and you know, I kind of get a small kick out of it every time he does it, because I'm like, yeah, actually I write for Channel Fireball, and that, you know, Channel Fireball is something people love, and I think that's why I got so much crap when I started writing. Because people were jealous, and I was a girl, and it was kind of an easy attack avenue, I guess. You know, they wanted to be the person writing on Channel Fireball. They didn't. They wanted to try and take that away from me. I still don't think I fully appreciate my 32nd at Nagoya. It all happening so fast, and yet, like, it always comes in little bursts. Like, I'll do really badly for a bit. Like, there was a time just before I won the first WMCQ where I actually seriously considered quitting Magic, like, really? For good, because I'd just been on the worst run. I think my win rate was like 33%, counting pre-releases, FNMs, like all the most, casual tournaments you can imagine. And I was just like, wow, how am I ever going to be any, like, I was obviously just lucky that one time, you know? And so I forget, and then as I said, I brewed the mono green deck and completely stomped the tournament with it. And I was like, oh yeah, I can play again. But you know, I'm in another down at the moment. I'm like, oh, I'm no good at Magic. Mm-hmm. So it's, you know, it's having that much success all at once and then having not success for a while can be quite hard to keep going, because you've tasted it.
Yeah.
You know, if you work up slowly and you slowly increase your skill level and you get there, I feel like you might be there a bit more consistently than I am at the moment. Whereas I'm definitely still learning. I still make all the stupid mistakes. But it is cool when I think about it.
Yeah. Yeah. I can
we just sit here and think about it for a minute?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. I can understand what you're saying. You know, there's definitely, I think I've heard the phrase, you know, when you're at the top, there's only one other place to go, and that's down. And I understand what you're saying about having that buildup where, you know, maybe you go through a couple years where you're not doing so well, but then there's this gradual, okay, so you win a PTQ. Okay. Then a couple more years, you know, then you go to the Pro Tour, but you don't do so hot, and then you qualify again. And we've had players sort of have that climb, and you know, with you, it really feels like you were on that rocket that just shot up.
Yeah.
And then it kind of reminds me of, I think it's like the Wile E. Coyote cartoons where he's riding the rocket and the rocket just stops as he's like in between the cliffs. And then, ooh, and yeah, I can understand that feeling.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's, yeah, that is a very good description, actually. But hopefully my rocket still goes occasionally. So.
I think it should.
Yeah, no, it does. Like, I definitely have days where I feel like I'm playing really well. But it's, to be honest, I think my biggest problem at the moment is I just don't get enough time to play Magic, which is kind of one of the problems of being in England, I guess. But I think we're going to come on to that later, so I won't ruin that question.
Are you hard on yourself?
Am I hard on myself? What, when I don't do well?
Oh, just in general, just like with the, when you don't do well, you know, maybe when you see other people doing well, when you miss opportunities, like, are you somebody who can take all of those things in stride? Or are you somebody who, you know, maybe takes a couple jabs at yourself internally?
I mean, I've been on tilt like everybody else. I can, if I do something stupid, I might punch myself internally once, but then, you know, I tell myself not to do it again rather than let it eat at me, I guess. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it probably depends on the day, and what's on the line, I guess. But yeah, I can be hard on myself. Mm-hmm. I guess that's fair.
Do you have a pretty good support system to go to? Like, if you're really, you know, if you need advice, or if you're trying to deal with things like, you know, your boyfriend and things like that?
Yeah, I mean, I've got a lot of friends that locally and at the sort of regional level, like at the PTQs or whatever, that if I'm having a bad day, they'll, you know, if I've had a bad match, you know, one of those, you know, you've totally got the win, but you draw anything but land for the next 10 turns, you know. You know, I've got people that will, they'll make me laugh and they'll make me think about something else for a bit. That's what I need. Like, you know, you have to reset your mental state. Yeah. If you've had a really sort of tilt engaging
mm-hmm. Oh, I know all about the tilt.
Yeah.
Tilt and I are like this, like fingers crossed.
Yeah. Tilt is, yeah, not pleasant.
Yeah. Now, you have represented England in the 2012 and 2013 World Magic Cups, and it's interesting because to hear the Americans say it, I don't know a lot of American pro players who get excited about the World Magic Cups the way that my friends overseas do. What is it about the experience that you enjoy that made you want to participate 2 years in a row?
It's kind of... I like to compete. I'll go to any qualifying tournament going. You know, yeah, the World Magic Cup isn't quite as good as the Pro Tour. But it's, you know, it's only one step down. GPs are below it. You know, you get to compete at the international level. And you get to kind of do it for your country. And I'm not like a big patriot. But you know, I am at least slightly patriotic, and competing for England is kind of cool.
Yeah.
I used to do archery quite competitively.
Really?
And I qualified to represent my county, which, not my country, that would have been nice, it wasn't that good. but my county of Cambridgeshire, and I was when I got the invite, I was really honored, because I was like, yeah, I get to represent something, and that's actually cool. I mean, I guess if you're playing, I mean, I wouldn't describe myself as a pro player the way that maybe the American pros that you're referring to would call themselves. Like, certainly a lot of, well, some American pros do it as their sort of their whole full-time job. Mm-hmm. which certainly isn't my case. I guess it can be a bit frustrating if you're doing Magic for that reason, to qualify for a team tournament where you don't get to kind of pick your teammates. Because mm-hmm. You might just end up with a team that you're just very frustrated by. I've been lucky both years and had teammates that are very nice, and we've worked well together. But maybe that's the reason. Or maybe it's just the odds of qualifying in America are just so small.
Yeah.
And you've got a long way to travel for your qualifiers. Like, I was complaining I had to go like a 6-hour drive.
Wow.
Actually, no, I don't think it was 6 hours. I think it was only 4 hour. A 6 hour would be put me in Scotland probably. You know, and I was like, oh man, it's so far away. But like, you know, you can have a plane flight to take. So mm-hmm. maybe it's that. Like, you know, I can attend all three qualifiers and there'll be like 120 people. So I've got reasonable odds of qualifying, whereas... Yeah, maybe you just can't get excited when you think your odds of qualifying are so small.
Yeah, I went to, we had, as far as I remember, we had three qualifiers in the United States. We had one in the West Coast, one in the Midwest, and one on the East Coast. And we went to the one in Chicago. Me and two of my girlfriends from Twitter, we met up in Chicago and we got a hotel room. And it basically turned into a girls' weekend. We had a really good time. And I think we had between 200 and 300 people at ours. And it was pretty intense. And it was a good time. Like, I knew that I probably wasn't going to win, but I was just excited that I had enough Planeswalker points to even get an invite. And then just to even be among all those people was really cool. And I met a lot of the local people from Chicago there that I've seen since then. And it was just a really good time. It was an excuse to get together with your girls and goof around a bit. And I enjoyed it. I would do it again. And I love seeing the pictures of the teams. Like, everybody looks so happy, and it's a good
Yeah,
time.
that's actually a really cool bit about it, like queuing up with your flag and getting your picture taken. So our team looked a lot happier this year. I don't know. We were a bit more like 2012's team was we got along fine, but 2013 I think we actually like we were quite good friends by the end of it. So I think that's sort of shone through in the picture a bit.
Did you know any of them beforehand?
Yeah, so actually our team captain had until literally about a month beforehand lived in Cambridge, and I'd literally learned to draft alongside him.
Wow.
Well, he already knew how to draft, but like he was at the LGS and he was one of the better players there, so I'd known him for forever. And the other two were both, regular PTQ players, because I mean that's kind of the advantage in England. Everyone goes to every PTQ because everything's close enough, so you see the same people again and again if you're going to all of them. So yeah, we kind of all knew each other beforehand, which is kind of useful.
Would you do it again? Would you like to try out for 2014?
I would if I was around. I'm hoping to be living in America in 2014. So
What?
yeah,
What's bringing you
big news.
here?
A job.
Okay.
So I no one in England wants to employ me. This is the very sad truth. It doesn't seem to matter if you have a degree from the University of Cambridge. They're like, we don't want you.
What?
So I've had to travel all the way to America to find a job. This is my sob story.
Is there
I
some tiny
don't know.
part of you? Is there a tiny part of you that's like, well, I get to play more magic while I'm there? Like.
So I may have been looking for a job in America because I could play more magic.
I knew it.
Yeah, I mean, I probably could have tried a bit harder to find a job in England, but the truth is, I was kind of offered an easy route in America. So I'm in academic science, and I actually met a researcher who works in New York at a conference while I was doing my PhD, and she said, "If you ever want a job in New York, you drop me a line." And so it was 3 years later, and I was like, there's no way she's going to remember this. And she obviously wasn't serious. But I sent her an email, and she was like, "I'd love to have you come." So, yeah, we're trying to sort out money and visas and all this stuff. So, I mean, there's a possibility it still never happens. But the idea is end of this year, early next year. But we don't know. So, if I am here, I will definitely go to the qualifiers because I like playing magic. But I might be kind of busy in the States
Oh, that's
trying to compete.
fantastic. That's really cool. I actually kind of went through that too. My most recent boyfriend, I live in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. He lived in Chicago, and we were debating moving in together, and the question came about of who was going to move where, and we were kind of hemming and hawing about that. And I don't know if you're familiar with Pastimes. Yeah,
Yes,
Pastimes is a really
that's
big
what
store
I
here, and they're also a tournament organizer. And Pastimes is located in Niles, Illinois, which isn't very far from Chicago. So publicly, I was telling people, yes, we're going to take that next step together, and we will be cohabitating as one lovely couple. And as I'm telling people this, I'm like Googling, going, local events, Chicago. Oh, there's a bronze on Wednesday and a platinum on. Yep, honey, I'll be home on Friday. That's fine. And a diamond on. Ooh-hoo-hoo. And yeah, so he. and then he would get really into it too. Like, he had no idea. So he'd be like, you know, I'm so excited. I love you so much. And I'm like, yeah. The tournament starts at 5. Can we wrap this up? Like, just, so, you know, it kind of, that turned out to be a problem, but, they call them perks. So one of the things I find really interesting, I've had a couple of, you know, English folks on my show before, and I know a couple people from across the pond on Twitter, and I've heard this from people from other countries as well, is that they say that they sometimes feel like they're at a disadvantage with regards to being able to get pro points and qualify for events because there just aren't as many events that take place. Is this something you can sympathize with?
Yeah, definitely. And this is something I alluded to earlier, and kind of why I wanted an excuse to go to America for a bit, is I don't get to play Magic very often. I mean, even at the level of my local game store, I mean, I get to draft on Tuesday, and I get to go to F&M once a month if I really want to. But it's so infrequently organized that I always miss it. Whereas, like, I was over in Boston. Oh, goodness, when was it? Must have been early this year. Oh, I can't remember. Sometime this year. And the LGS I went to in Cambridge, because we looked it up to somewhere to go and do stuff for some evenings, they have events on every evening, and all sorts of events, like Sealed, and Legacy, and mm-hmm. Proxy Vintage, and Modern. And I was like, I want this. Like, if I was playing Magic every day of the week, I'm sure I would get better. And, you know, when you're talking about the level of pro points, I've stopped going to GPs because I can't be bothered. I can't get enough pro points. And I've done terribly at every GP I've attended, but that is not the point. you know, I don't feel like there's much point in me trying for pro points because I would just kind of have to do really well at so many of them. I know they've just changed the policies so that it's your best 5 finishes or whatever, but you still get more chances to get those best 5 finishes if you live in America than if you live in Europe. And as you were saying about Chicago, you've got the SCG qualifiers, you've got the TCG events. There's just so much you can go to that, like, I would actually keep up with Standard, I would keep up with Modern, whatever format is relevant. Whereas at the moment, like, I can go months without paying attention to Standard because I literally don't have a tournament. And then suddenly there'll be one next week and I'll be like, oh, what's the meta doing? What deck should I be playing? You know, and, you know, I do fine, but so the tournament, if I'm going to win a PTQ in a season, it tends to be the last, one of the later ones in a season, mm-hmm. because I've just been playing, you know, I'll have been playing that format for, you know, 6 weeks or something. Yeah. And I'll now finally be really happy with a deck, like, you know, that next step on that I can just then take it through a tournament and win with it. Whereas, yeah, if I'm just playing more, that would hopefully happen a bit more easily.
Yeah. So you had mentioned your job, and your full-time job outside of Magic involves studying breast cancer. What made you decide to get into this particular field?
Nothing really. I know a lot of people in my lab are like, oh, you know, I had, my mum died from breast cancer when I was 12, or similar reasons. But I literally just sort of ended up there. I know that's not a very exciting reason.
Seems to be a theme with you, is just ending up places. Like, I just ended up.
I know. I literally wander through until I bump into something. And then I'm like, yeah, this is fine. What are we doing? I know. Maybe I should take some more directive, more direct actions in my life at it. I'd met, my PhD was in breast cancer, but I met my PhD supervisor because she offered me a summer job position. So, I mean, I had contacted her because I thought breast cancer was kind of interesting, but yeah, it was a shot in the dark rather than I'm really passionate about breast cancer. I want to cure everything. But I did stay. I did my summer job with her. And then she, as these things seem to go in my life, she offered me a PhD. And I said, no, I'm going to do something else. And then I couldn't find a job. Mm-hmm. See, why can I never find jobs? Anyway, I couldn't find a job. So I went back to her and said, I'm really sorry, I can't find a job. But thank you, because you'd been writing references for me for all these jobs I'd applied for that no one wanted me for. And I said, thank you for writing all these references, but I'm going to need some more. And she was like, this is ridiculous. You're really good. We'll employ you. So she put me in as a research technician. And then after I'd been with her again for a while, she offered the PhD position again. And I was like, well, I guess I could do this stuff, but get a PhD at the end of it for 3 years. So we found funding and I did a PhD in breast cancer. But I mean, I'm now staying in the field. I think it's, you know, I think cancer as a whole is a very interesting field. Finding a cure might be kind of tricky, but we're doing our best.
So when you say studying breast cancer, that's specifically what you're trying for. You're working on the cure.
No, so I'm. If you imagine the cure as a giant ladder that we're fitting the rungs in, I am like the bottom rung. Mm-hmm. I'm like that rung that everyone forgets because they probably didn't even step in it. They stepped on the circle. it's kind of sad. But no, I mean, I work on the very basic biology of how a breast normally works, because you can't understand how it's gone wrong until you understand how it normally works. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I'm kind of, I go from that, you know, I find the normal mechanism and see if by altering it we end up with cancer, and then that will be taken normally by a pharmaceutical company somewhere will read my research and will go, well, maybe we can target this normal process that they found can be altered in cancer. Mm-hmm. And then they'll try and develop a drug for that, and then they'll take it through screening and whatever. So, you know, it can be 10 years before any research I do can be a meaningful outcome, and it's there's a lot of us trying to fill in that bottom rung, and one of those rungs will be good. Mm-hmm. The others will turn out to be faulty. So it can be a kind of dissatisfying sort of place to work, a sort of thing to work in, because you can do a lot of work that will never be of relevance, except that, but you know, we have to check everything, if you see what I mean, mm-hmm. to work out. You know, until someone's checked it, we can't go, well, actually, that's not any use.
Right.
So, you know, even if my research turns out to not be of any use to the cure, I have ticked off and checked off some boxes on the way. So, mm-hmm. But yeah, so I won't generate the cure, but my research might generate the cure, I guess, is the.
Yeah. See, my mom was a breast cancer survivor. She was diagnosed about 6 years ago, and we come from a very medical family. So she was able to, fortunately, there was early detection. She detected it very early. And at that point, they were like, well, we can just remove, you know, the portion that has, you know, the cancer. And she was just like, just take the whole thing. She's like, you know, I know how this is going to go. I'm informed. Just take the breast. And she had her left breast removed. And I have a great appreciation for people who are working towards that end, because we were very lucky. You know, we had a good attitude. There was the early detection. She was surrounded by amazing medical staff. We had insurance, which is something not everybody in America can say. She was able to find great mentors who had survived as well that she could go to. And, you know, I just feel like we got lucky all around. And, you know, she was able to afford a new breast. And, you know, we tried making it fun, if such could be said, you know, because I feel like it was really easy for people to immediately go the sadness route. So you know,
and cancer's interesting. So we were talking about having a good attitude in a magic tournament, you know, having fun and it tends to go better. Mm-hmm. And that's also true medically.
Yeah.
You know, if you are happy and positive about something, it tends to have a much better outcome.
Oh, yeah.
And that's quite well proven scientifically. So mm-hmm. mental state is good. So it's good that you were putting a positive attitude into that.
Yeah. So like, you know, when she lost the breast, there were people that were more devastated than we were. And she mm-hmm. had to have an implant put in, and we went implant shopping, and we were like, you know, we would go looking at magazines. Oh, her boobs are nice. Can we get one of hers? And then I remember they lost her boob in the mail. So we joked about that. Oh, yeah. It was so funny. You had to go tracking a boob on the US Postal Service website. So we had to go looking for that then. And then when she got the boob, I was like, Mom, can I feel your boob? And my dad would slap my head. He's like, you're not feeling your mother's breasts. And I'm like, I want to know. And so we just kept trying to keep it light. And I remember that there were people who would think that they were doing good, but they weren't. So like people would call and they'd be crying. I remember one time my cousin called and it was right before the holidays and he called up crying. He's like, I had this dream that you were dead. And I'm like, you don't tell the cancer patient you're having a dream. She's dead. You're not helping. And there were just people who thought they were trying to feel better about themselves and they were trying to cope in their own way and they want to share with you. And you really had to, like, I felt like we had to put her in a bubble sometimes because we just had to keep all the negativity away and keep all the sadness away. And I really feel like by doing that, we gave her that much better of a chance. What would you say has been the hardest part about your research so far? Like if you could, you know, simply say like what's taking so long or what's so hard to understand about it, what would it be?
Also, there's just so much unknown. And honestly, the most frustrating thing in science is that people don't share. Science is set up really badly at the moment because a lab's ability to get more funding stems from them publishing good research, which makes sense. I mean, if you're a grant committee and you've got like £5 million to give to someone, are you going to give it to the lab that hasn't published any meaningful results, or are you going to give it to the lab that's just published this like really exciting paper in a really good journal?
Right.
You're going to give it to that lab, right? Because they've done something good before. Unfortunately, this generates a culture where no one shares, because if you've got something good and someone steals it from you, that will mean they get your funding and you don't get any funding.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really awkward because I feel like science as a whole, I mean, not just in breast cancer, this is any science, it's probably wasting a lot of time repeating results that someone else has already done because no one wants to tell anyone about what they're doing.
Mm.
And that's a real shame. And it really irritates me.
Mm-hmm.
The whole politics side of things, you know, if I feel, you know, for the good of mankind, if we all just shared what we were doing, it would be fine. But unfortunately, the way we've set up everything, that's never going to work out.
Goes back to that whole having a better attitude thing, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. But, you know, I've heard stories of people having their research stolen from them. And that's pretty painful. I you know, it was something I was scared about during my PhD, because if my research suddenly got published by someone else, I don't even have a PhD anymore. Like, I have nothing to submit to my examiners to say, look, I did this work. So I didn't tell anyone what I was working on. So, you know, I'm part of the problem, not part of the solution. But I don't know if that will ever change, but I would hope it would change. But especially in the current climate, with research money being cut by everybody, governments, charities, you know, no one wants to pay for research.
Mm-hmm.
So what little there is, you've really got to fight for. So that's kind of a bad situation for science at the moment. But,
well, I'm certainly glad that you're on the front lines, at least.
Yeah, I'm trying my best. There's so much going on in certainly breast cancer. It's very tricky because, I mean, people will say to you that, you know, when's the cure for breast cancer coming? And I go, well, it depends which form of breast cancer you're talking about, because cancer as a term is terrible, because we say, oh, so and so had lung cancer or so and so had bone cancer, but even within that particular cancer, there are lots and lots of different subtypes, and people often, you know, non-scientists often don't realize that. And so when, you know, we've got a pretty good cure for one type of breast cancer. But if you don't have that type of breast cancer, then it won't work. But then they get all upset because you're not giving them the breast cancer cure. It's like, well, why don't I get the cure? And you're like, because it won't do anything.
Mm-hmm.
I'm like, but I have breast cancer. No, it's the other type of breast. Oh, and you go in circles. And it's very frustrating. And yeah, unfortunately, they're all going to require slightly different cures. Probably what they'll actually require is some sort of tailor-made individual drugs, which will be a little bit delayed because we're not quite at that level of scientific development. But we'll get there.
Sure.
We'll get there.
Sure.
Probably targeted gene therapy. Why not?
So, Carrie, if anybody has enjoyed listening to you on the Duck Tease, how can they find you? Where can they find you? How can they get in touch with you?
There, so I have a Twitter account which is at Onion Pixie. That's Pixie with a IE, not a Y. I tweet infrequently, but whenever I do, I seem to cause some big uproar, like, you know, whether or not we should ban a card or whatever. And then everyone starts shouting at me, and I'm like, I just wanted to make an innocent tweet. Like, why is everyone shouting at me? I also have a Facebook account, which is just Carrie Oliver. I'm the one from Cambridge that looks like me, I guess. But yeah, those are probably the best ways to get to me. I'm very, as I'm sure you can testify, I'm very delinquent at replying to messages, but I read them, I ingest them, and sometimes I remember to reply. But it's nothing personal, and I love getting messages, so feel free to send me messages and questions. That's
I was meaning to ask you, Carrie, what does Onion Pixie mean? Where does that come from?
fine. Onion Pixie. So yeah, I was really disappointed when I started my Twitter account and I asked everybody. Well, I said there were prizes for, you know, if you knew what Onion Pixie came from. And lots of people Googled it because that's very boring and they still couldn't find out what it was from. Onion Pixie is, Onion Pixie with a Y is a computer game character from a game called Puyo Pop Fever, which is kind of a cross between, it's kind of like, what's that game called? Bubble?
Bubble
You know, the
Bobble?
games where you, Bubble, yeah, where you shoot like colored blocks at stuff.
Oh God, now I
But it's
can't think of
also,
it. Yeah.
well, anyway, you know, everyone who's listening knows what I mean. It's a cross between kind of that and Bejeweled. Is it Bejeweled where you put different colors together and then they break and then you can more can fall down, you can get
Yeah,
more
they're
matches.
gems.
Yeah, so it's kind of like a cross between those two things. It's that sort of genre of game. But so it's got a story mode where you go through and you have to challenge all of the other characters in the game. You know, there's always some terrible plot reason as to why you're doing this. But one of them's called Onion Pixie, and it's a little, well, basically it's a little onion with a pair of legs. And he when he enters the scene, the audio says onion, onion. But this it's all subtitled, and the subtitle says boing boing. So I was never really sure what the disparity was there. And I kind of adopted it when I needed a live journal handle. I don't expect that account still exists. Better not. There's probably just rubbish on it. Because I was called Pixie at school. By a couple of kids. So I kind of was like, oh, that's kind of similar. And then I took the Y off because that's awful. You want an IE.
Yeah.
So there you go. It's a computer game character from a half playable game.
Interesting. See, I immediately went to just to kind of date myself here. I remember when I was a kid, there was there was a game for Nintendo called Princess Tomato and the Salad Kingdom, and it's a
Right.
thing. You can Wikipedia it, people.
All
And
right, all right.
the princess is a tomato. She's a princess. This is horrible claymation, and she's a tomato head. And her peers or her friends are also vegetables. And I was like, maybe there's like a fairy with an onion head. Like maybe that's what it is. Like that's immediately where my mind went to. And maybe she's from the Salad Kingdom too. And that's immediately my first thought. So I'm glad to hear that I was mostly wrong. Well, Carrie, thank you. Sorry.
Sorry, I was gonna say no, I'm just a very sad looking onion with a mace, apparently. I couldn't even remember what he looked like. I've just Googled it and I look really sad actually. It looks like I've got a little unicorn horn, so maybe that's appropriate because we all know I love unicorns.
Have been an absolute joy to have on the show. Thank you so much for coming
Thank
on,
you,
Carrie.
sir. That was good. Thank you.
And if anybody else is listening and you've enjoyed the deck tease, you can always find me first and foremost on legitmtg.com. Then you can find me on iTunes and Stitcher. Feel free to subscribe and leave me a couple stars or a review or a thumbs up. You can follow the show on Twitter at the deck tease. You can follow me personally on Twitter at original estrus, originalestrus, or you can email me at estrus@elitistjerks.com. Thank you guys so much for listening, and please take care of yourselves, okay? Bye.